It's 11 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is Newsdesk with David Austin. The headlines: there have been new accusations that the killing of Rwandan Hutu refugees in the former Zaire is still going on. The Italian Prime Minister has begun addressing Parliament in a fresh attempt to stave off defeat over his government's austerity budget. Bosnian Muslims have won local elections in the Serb stronghold of Srebrenica, where thousands of Muslims were killed in the war by Serb forces. And a court ruling in Hong Kong means hundreds of illegal child immigrants now face being sent back to mainland China. Also in the next half hour, the United States designates the Tamil Tigers as a terrorist organization. And there's another big financial scandal in South Korea. New allegations have been made that the Rwandan army and forces of the Congolese president, Laurent Kabila, have massacred thousands of Rwandan Hutu refugees in the former Zaire, and that the killings are continuing. The Human Rights Watch organization, based in the United States, and the International Federation of Human Rights say a team they sent to Congo after Mr. Kabila took power in May has photographed mass graves and the remains of civilian refugees. The report says the United States knew in advance of the plan to attack refugees and either supported or ignored it. This report comes from our United Nations correspondent Rob Watson in New York.
This is a damning and damaging report for both President Laurent Kabila and his allies in Rwanda's Tutsi-dominated government. Although the allegations of massacres aren't new, Human Rights Watch has gone further than any other organization so far in pointing the finger of blame. It says the Rwandan government had been determined right from the start to use the rebellion to take revenge on the Hutu fighters responsible for the 1994 genocide and also on the thousands of civilians who'd followed them into exile in the former Zaire. Human Rights Watch says Rwanda's Tutsi-dominated army was assisted in carrying out the massacres by Congolese, Ugandan and Burundian supporters of Laurent Kabila's rebellion. The organization also accuses the United States of being well aware of Rwanda's intention to attack the refugee camps and of either supporting the idea or at best turning a blind eye to it. This report comes as the United Nations is struggling to decide what to do about its own stalled investigation into the alleged killings. Many African countries, and to some extent Washington, are urging the UN to take a sympathetic approach to President Kabila for fear of creating instability in the region. But Human Rights Watch says the UN should press ahead in order to end the cycle of killings in the Great Lakes area.
Rob Watson reporting from New York. Two soldiers have been killed in the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kinshasa, after intense artillery exchanges across the Congo River, which separates it from Brazzaville, the Congolese capital. The soldiers were reportedly killed by rockets which fell near the office of the president, Laurent Kabila. The deputy interior minister said the barrage of rockets and mortars from Brazzaville amounted to a declaration of war. President Kabila's forces responded by firing at Brazzaville, where soldiers of President Pascal Lissouba are fighting militiamen loyal to the former military leader, Denis Sassou Nguesso. It's unclear which faction fired at Kinshasa. Moves to achieve a return to civilian rule in Sierra Leone are expected to be discussed today at a meeting in Nigeria of the group of five West African countries delegated to deal with the situation. A Nigerian plane from the West African force in Sierra Leone yesterday bombed the defense headquarters in the capital, Freetown, killing at least four people. The air raid came on the day that the UN Security Council imposed sanctions on the military regime, which deposed the elected president of Sierra Leone in May. The French Foreign Minister, Hubert Védrine, is visiting South Africa today. Mr. Védrine started his African tour in Gabon. His trip is the first by a French dignitary to the continent since the new socialist government in Paris announced a radical overhaul of its foreign policy in the region. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. The Italian Prime Minister, Romano Prodi, has begun addressing Parliament in a final effort to win support for next year's austerity budget and save his administration. The Communist Refoundation Party, on which the government depends for its parliamentary majority, has threatened to vote against the budget, and government officials have been working on a package intended to gain the support of the communists. Orla Guerin reports from Rome.
Italy's beleaguered Prime Minister, Romano Prodi, has renewed his appeal to his sometime communist allies to back the budget. In an address to Parliament, which was broadcast live on national television, he pleaded once again for their support. And he made it clear that if they do not back the budget in a crucial vote later today, he will resign. Key members of Italy's ruling centre-left alliance do believe a compromise which could save the government is possible. Italy's Deputy Prime Minister, Walter Veltroni, has said there is some hope of a deal. The government plans to present revised budget proposals to Parliament later today. Mr. Prodi insists the budget can't be modified too much. It has to be tough, he says, to get Italy into the single European currency. The Communist Refoundation Party has demanded a long list of concessions in the budget, including a reduction in the working week, new job creation measures, and protection for pensions. There's no guarantee of a breakthrough, but the government is trying to find ways to satisfy the communists without disfiguring the budget.
Orla Guerin reporting from Rome. The lower house of the Russian parliament, the Duma, begins the first reading of the ITS government's controversial budget today, amid signs of a deepening rift between the deputies and the Russian president, Boris Yeltsin. President Yeltsin has hinted he might dissolve the Duma if it continues to block legislation. Yesterday, the Duma unanimously approved a resolution criticizing the government's performance as unsatisfactory. It said the Russian government had failed to achieve its social and economic objectives. From Moscow, Robert Parsons reports.
Russia's parliamentary deputies show every sign of spoiling for a fight. Despite Prime Minister Chernomyrdin's stated readiness to seek compromise on the budget, communist leader Gennady Zyuganov has warned the government to withdraw it or face defeat. He said the budget meant more of the shock therapy that had been ruining Russia. He's supported by the liberal Yabloko party, which has warned of a colossal crisis of finances in 1998. But that's not a view shared by most Western financial advisers, who have described the budget as one of the most responsible since the collapse of the Soviet Union. President Yeltsin feels both his own credibility and that of his government is on the line. Parliament is already blocking vital legislation on a new tax code and land ownership. Rejection outright of the budget would undermine the government's short and medium-term strategy for economic growth. The Russian leader has warned that his patience with the Duma is nearing its end, hinting that he may dissolve Parliament and call new elections. That may just be enough to persuade deputies to back away from full-scale confrontation. The chances are that this time round, deputies will opt to send the budget for revision by parliamentary commission, postponing a clash and raising the chances of a compromise at a later date.
Robert Parsons in Moscow. European monitors say Bosnian Muslims have won a local election in Srebrenica, despite the town being almost entirely populated by Serbs. More than 70% of Srebrenica's population was Muslim until 1995, when Bosnian Serb troops overran the town, killing thousands of Muslim men. James Kumarasamy has just sent this report from the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo.
A spokesman for the OSCE confirmed that the Muslim Coalition for a United and Democratic Bosnia-Herzegovina had won a slim majority in Srebrenica. The coalition will have 24 of the 46 seats on the municipal council. It's an important result in a town that suffered what's been described as one of the worst atrocities since the Second World War. In 1995, Bosnian Serbs killed or arrested thousands of Bosnian Muslims as they tried to flee Srebrenica, which at the time had been designated a United Nations safe haven. Although Srebrenica is now a Bosnian Serb stronghold, the municipal elections allowed Bosnians who had been forced to flee their homes to vote in their original places of residence. Krisjanovski, a spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, said the result offered a unique opportunity. He said that the people of Srebrenica had shown courage and wisdom, but added that if the results were not implemented, it would be a tragedy for Bosnia-Herzegovina. Observers say that putting the results into practice will be a hard task. Srebrenica is the only town in Serb-controlled territory to have voted in a Muslim council in these elections. The current nationalist authorities will be loath to reverse the results of their territorial gains.
James Kumarasamy reporting from Sarajevo. The United States has acted to cut any American support for 30 foreign groups it's classified as terrorist organizations. It'll now be illegal for their members to enter the country and for United States residents to provide them with funds. Announcing the list, the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, described terrorism as one of the most important security challenges since the Cold War. About half the groups listed are based in the Middle East. Others are from Asia and Latin America. But the Clinton administration decided not to include the IRA because of the ceasefire in its campaign against British rule in Northern Ireland. The Sri Lankan government has welcomed the American decision to designate the Tamil Tiger rebel movement as a terrorist organization. A statement released by the Sri Lankan Foreign Ministry describes the move as a major victory against the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. From Colombo, Flora Botsford reports.
The Sri Lankan government has been campaigning hard for the State Department to include the Tamil Tigers on its list of terrorist organizations. The decision has been welcomed in Colombo as a major triumph of foreign policy. In a recent meeting with Madeleine Albright, the Sri Lankan Foreign Minister Lakshman Kadigama stressed the need to bring the LTTE under American anti-terrorism laws, which will freeze the organization's assets in the United States, ban members from entering the country, and severely curb fundraising. Although the decision is undoubtedly a big morale boost for the Sri Lankan government, it's still not clear how much of a direct impact it will have on the Tamil Tiger rebel movement. It does not, for example, require America's closest allies, Britain, Canada and Australia, to take action against the LTTE, and the organization is far more active in these countries. The situation is made all the more complex by the Sri Lankan government's refusal to ban the Tamil Tigers on their own soil. Colombo wants to keep the door open for future peace talks with the LTTE if and when certain preconditions have been met. There's been no comment so far from the Tamil Tigers themselves, but this will have come as a blow to their long-running political campaign, which attempts to portray the LTTE as the sole and legitimate representatives of the Tamil minority in Sri Lanka. They have always denied carrying out terrorist attacks, such as the central bank bombing last year.
Flora Botsford in Colombo. You're tuned to London and the BBC World Service. A reminder of our top story in Newsdesk. Two human rights organizations say they've obtained irrefutable proof that Rwandan Hutu refugees in the former Zaire were killed in large numbers. They say there is also evidence that killings are still going on. Still to come in the program, English as you might never have heard it before. It's in a new dictionary being released in Britain today, and we'll tell you all about it after the rest of the main world news and sport. A court in Hong Kong has opened the way for the expulsion of hundreds of children from mainland China who entered the territory illegally to join their parents. In a test case brought by five children, the court upheld new immigration laws which require them to return home until their claim of right to abode is established. As James Miles reports from Hong Kong, the court's decision will be greeted with relief by the government, but will be far less welcome to human rights activists.
In a crucial test case, lawyers for five illegal immigrants from mainland China had been trying to persuade a Hong Kong court that their clients, who are aged between 8 and 19, should be allowed to stay here. Their argument was that the post-colonial constitution gives the right of abode in Hong Kong to any person born on the Chinese mainland with at least one parent from the former British colony. Had they won, tens of thousands of mainland children would effectively have been given a green light to ignore immigration rules and enter Hong Kong by whatever means to join their parents here. But the judge has rejected the immigrants' appeal and upheld the validity of a new law which requires such children to wait for the necessary permits before entering the territory. Because mainland officials often demand huge bribes in exchange for such permits, applicants sometimes have to wait for several years. This is why some parents resort to paying criminals to bring their children across the border illegally. Hundreds of children now face possible deportation as a result of the court's ruling. The judgment is likely to anger not only thousands of families, but also human rights activists, who say the new immigration law restricts a right enshrined in the Constitution and therefore sets a dangerous precedent for the curtailment of other rights.
That was James Miles in Hong Kong. South Korea has been hit by another big financial scandal, which could have a decisive impact on presidential elections, which are just 2.5 months away. The ruling New Korea Party alleges that the opposition leader, Kim Dae-jung, who's leading in the opinion polls, has amassed a secret political fund of more than $60 million. From Seoul, Charles Scanlon reports.
Until now, it's been the most open election campaign in South Korea's turbulent history. For the first time, the veteran opposition leader Kim Dae-jung seemed to stand a realistic chance of unseating the ruling party, which has never lost a presidential election. But with time running out before December's poll, the ruling New Korea Party has struck what it hopes will be the killer blow against the opposition leader. The party's secretary general alleged that Kim Dae-jung had a secret slush fund of more than $60 million, which he'd laundered under borrowed and false names in 349 bank accounts. South Korean newspapers said the evidence appeared to have been systematically gathered over a long period of time, probably with the help of government agencies. The opposition denounced the allegations as a politically motivated smear and said it would reveal evidence of illegal fundraising by the ruling party candidate Lee Kwei-chang. At 71, Kim Dae-jung is standing for president for the fourth time. He was kidnapped, imprisoned, and once sentenced to death during the years of military rule, when he was frequently denigrated at election time as a communist sympathizer. The latest allegations have hit economic confidence in South Korea, which has yet to recover from a series of major corporate collapses. Large industrial groups are bracing themselves for a new round of investigations into illegal campaign contributions and money laundering.
That was Charles Scanlon in Seoul. Following the collapse of many Southeast Asian currencies over the past few months, the Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has said that a fund to help East Asian countries would need $100 billion. He also said the fund would help those countries which fall into financial difficulties in the region. But as our economics correspondent James Morgan reports, the Malaysian proposals may be seen as a potential threat to the International Monetary Fund and may face American opposition.
The idea of a special fund to help Asian countries sprang from the crisis which has engulfed Southeast Asia. Japan was the main force behind the scheme and enjoyed the backing of most members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The Japanese have been worried by the crisis. Their exports to a fast-growing region are threatened, and the decline of its currencies mean that in certain areas, competition with Japanese products will intensify. On the other hand, the idea of an emergency facility is opposed by the International Monetary Fund and the United States. Both see it as a potential threat to the authority of the IMF. If Asian governments think there's a huge pot of money ready if they fall into trouble, they might be tempted to take risks and avoid the conditions the IMF demands for its help. China, meanwhile, doesn't like the idea of Japan taking the lead in a region that it sees as its back garden. But Malaysian domestic politics possibly lie behind the latest developments. The Deputy Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, has been having to reassure markets that the recent anti-market rhetoric of his boss, Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, isn't as troubling as it sounds. That leaves him looking rather conservative, so he too is having to make radical proposals to show he supports the current activism that guides Malaysian financial policy.
Our economics correspondent, James Morgan. America's top central banker, Alan Greenspan, has revived investor fears of a possible stock market crash by warning the US economy that it's growing at an unsustainable rate. The worst hit of the big four stock markets was Hong Kong, where share prices fell by nearly 4%. Here's Max Foster of our business staff.
It was the bluntest warning from Mr. Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, in many months. He said the US economy was on an unsustainable path, and that the rapid rise in the number of jobs was almost certain to lead to reviving inflation. Mr. Greenspan said the question was not if the rapid growth would lead to inflation, but when. He also hinted that he felt stock markets around the world were too high. This hint carried additional resonance for many investors who were watching warily as the 10th anniversary of the stock market crash of 1987 approaches on October the 19th. On that occasion, share prices in New York fell 23% in a single day, and it took several years for prices to recover. Although at the time it was unclear if the stock market fall would have wider repercussions for the world economy, it did in fact predate the recession in the US and UK of 1989-1991. Of the four main world stock markets, Tokyo fell by 1.5% after his remarks to 17,376 points. Wall Street by just over 1%. London is little changed at 52.48, but by far the worst affected has been Hong Kong with a fall of 4%. There was good news, however, for Southeast Asian currencies, which recovered some of their losses against the US dollar. On the foreign exchanges, at the moment, the dollar's trading at 1 German mark 75 and 121 Japanese yen, and the pound costs $1.62.
That was Max Foster. President Fidel Castro of Cuba has told the Communist Party Congress in Havana that Cuba has defied the United States and remains firmly on its socialist course. President Castro made the assertion in an energetic speech delivered without notes and lasting almost 7 hours. The Congress is the first since the economic crisis which enveloped Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mr. Castro said market reforms encouraging foreign investment were needed for Cuba to survive. We have to live in the world of today, he said, but our ideas will endure. A Mexican airline is pressing the Colombian authorities for tougher action against drug smugglers after being suspected of possible involvement in trafficking. The airline, which has suspended flights to the Colombian capital Bogota, blames Colombians for smuggling cocaine onto its flights. Emma Patterson reports from Mexico City.
Mexicana, one of the two largest airlines in Mexico, says it's extremely worried about security at Colombia's main airport. In a statement, the company said the ban would remain in force until Colombian officials had taken effective measures to control drug trafficking. The ban, which comes into effect on Thursday, follows the discovery earlier this month of 30 kilograms of cocaine hidden between two panels on the belly of a passenger plane. It was only 3 months ago that another illegal consignment was discovered stuffed inside the spare wheel of one of their aircraft. Both planes had been flying out of Colombia. The airline's maintenance staff and crew members are now believed to be under investigation. United States anti-drug agents are also reported to be carrying out an inquiry and have placed Mexicana on their list of suspicious airlines. The register is used to guide U.S. customs officials who are obliged to rigorously check all high-risk planes. Mexicana has denied any responsibility, and their latest announcement is clearly intended to demonstrate what they insist is their unwitting involvement in this latest scandal.
Emma Patterson. The United States Army has announced it's to court-martial its most senior enlisted soldier on charges of sexual misconduct. The soldier, Gene McKinney, who holds the position of Sergeant Major of the Army, faces charges brought against him by six servicewomen, including adultery, indecent assault, and soliciting sex. Mr. McKinney says his accusers are racially motivated. He's the first black man in the post he holds. His accusers are all white. He was suspended from duty in February. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. It's now 11:23 Greenwich Mean Time. Sports news now, and for the first test between Pakistan and South Africa, it seems to be heading for a draw in Rawalpindi. But there's some bad news for one of the Pakistani players, who's now facing a court appearance. Sumant Bhatia has the details.
Well, South Africa, starting the fourth day on 138 for one, have got over their first hurdle of passing the follow-on mark of 256 for the loss of four wickets. And the latest score we do have is 278 for five. Last man out was the captain, Hansi Akronya. But there's been a blow to the Pakistani team off the field. Their batsman, Inzaman Al-Haq, has now been summoned to appear before a court in Toronto to face assault charges. It follows his confrontation with a spectator last month during a one-day match against India. Inzaman will now appear before the court on the 31st of October, at which time a trial date will be fixed. Athletes and officials have begun arriving in Jakarta for the Southeast Asian Games, which begin on Saturday. But there are fears that the smog that's badly affected Indonesia and Malaysia may blow across the city. And the collapse of regional currencies mean many team budgets have been squeezed. Spending on the opening ceremony has also been cut by almost a third. And that's the sports news.
And that was Sumant Bhatia. Now, have you ever thought of using a Twinkie defence? Do you live in a twigloo? Or are you just a mouse potato? Well, if you don't know what I'm talking about, then perhaps you need a new dictionary, which is being launched in Britain today. The dictionary defines words like twigloo and mouse potato, as well as all the other expressions which have entered the English language over the past 15 years. The dictionary of new words includes entries from a wide variety of sources and aims to reflect the changing face of society. Our British Affairs correspondent is Grant Ferret.
New words and expressions are entering the English language all the time. The new dictionary brings together 2,000 of the most commonly used. Some, like political correctness and mobile, the abbreviation of mobile phone, need little explanation. But others would leave many people baffled. What, for example, is a dwem? According to the dictionary, it's a derogatory term denoting any of the great historical European writers, artists, and thinkers. In fact, it's an acronym for dead white European male, and like many of the entries, was coined in the United States. American English is also the source of the Twinkie defense, in which a defendant in court argues that his criminal behavior was caused by eating too much junk food, such as Twinkie cakes. Increasing concerns about the environment are also reflected in the book. Anti-roads protesters have given us the word twigloo, defined as a temporary shelter made of branches and often found in the trees along the proposed route of a new road. New technology also prompts a large number of entries, such as mini-disc and, for those addicted to their computer, mouse potatoes. The jargon-littered world of business is not forgotten. While the meaning of downshifting is reasonably clear, presenteeism isn't immediately obvious. It's a condition which afflicts employees who are so worried about losing their job that they have difficulty leaving the office.
Our British Affairs correspondent, Grant Ferret. Now to end the programme, another look at the main points. Two human rights organisations say they've obtained irrefutable proof that Rwandan Hutu refugees in the former Zaire were killed in large numbers. They say there is also evidence that killings are still going on. The Italian Prime Minister, Romano Prodi, has been making a new appeal in Parliament for support for next year's austerity budget, saying he'll resign if he doesn't get sufficient backing in a vote later today. He indicated he was prepared to make concessions over pensions. It's been announced that the Bosnian Muslims have won the local elections in Srebrenica on absentee votes, despite the town now being almost entirely populated by Serbs. Srebrenica was one of the worst examples of the policy known as ethnic cleansing during the Bosnian Civil War. And a court in Hong Kong has ruled that children from mainland China who joined their parents in the territory without proper documents must return home until their claim to right of abode is established. 2,000 children could now face expulsion. Well, since we've been on air, this year's Nobel Prize for Literature has just been announced. It's been awarded to the Italian playwright and actor Dario Fo. He was cited by the Swedish Academy for emulating the gestures of the Middle Ages in scourging authority and upholding the dignity of the downtrodden. Here's our correspondent, Julian Isherwood.
The decision was taken this morning after voting in the Swedish Academy on a short list of five authors. We don't know who the others were, as the Academy's extremely secretive. The Academy said it had decided to award the prize to the 71-year-old Fo because his art managed to emulate the gestures of the Middle Ages in scourging authority while at the same time upholding the dignity of the downtrodden. The decision was surprising but seems to have pleased the literary critics. The Academy's been in the habit of choosing rather obscure literary figures and has been widely criticised. Fo's plays are modern, very popular and often played in the streets. One of his central works is the Mistero Buffo from 1969, followed by The Accidental Death of an Anarchist from 1970. And this year's choice for the prize is likely to be highly popular indeed.
That was Julian Isherwood reporting from Copenhagen on this year's Nobel Prize for Literature, which has just been announced. And that's the end of this edition of News Desk from the BBC in London.